Thank you very much, Marcus. You spoke of the annihilation of electrons and particles and the almost symmetrical distribution of the energy as it came from that collision. Now, I'm aware, as I'm sure that you are, that the whole of the universe has a wonderful symmetry because all these things seem to balance. If we look through our wonderful telescopes in 2009, we see a whole array of not just stars and bits of planetary matter and so on, we see whole galaxies. What evidence is there to suggest that the galaxies that we see are all matter as we know it? Is it possible that some of those galaxies are actually antimatter galaxies? Because I feel, and I think that you'll probably agree with me, that antimatter and matter can't possibly be unbalanced in its distribution in the universe. There is a balance of some sort. So we would expect there to be an equal amount of antimatter and matter. I'd like to hear your views on that.
Well, it's a very logical view to take that there must be an equal amount. Actually, there are tiny subtle differences between antimatter and matter, a particle and its antiparticle property. Possibly that there is scope for somehow being different amounts of matter and antimatter. Now, can you tell whether a galaxy is made of antimatter or not? It's kind of difficult because antimatter basically behaves in the same way as matter. If you had an antimatter version of you, you would still function as a person. All the interactions between your antimatter atoms would go in pretty well exactly the same way that your matter ones would. It's only when you bring them together that you'd actually notice any interaction. Also, the thing is that we observe galaxies through light or infrared radio waves. They're all electromagnetic radiation. That's all carried by photons. Photons are not particle antiparticle specific. In fact, a photon is its own antiparticle, which is a bit strange, but there are not antiphotons. So, in that sense, we can't actually tell if we're seeing a photon whether it's being emitted by a particle, an antiparticle. So, that makes it rather hard to tell whether we're seeing.
Hang on. Can we get the microphone over here? Thank you. Well,
I believe that there is a subtle difference in the spectrum of certain chemical things in what's known as the fine structure between matter and antimatter that has actually been observed in Earth experiments. And the astronomical evidence is that just about everything that they have not detected any antimatter galaxies.
Okay, that may be true. Yeah, I'm not a cosmologist.
I was just wondering if you could explore a little bit further for us the question of God and the experiments of the climate, but removing the question of God, as I think that was more of an immediate detail, sort of something controversial to explain, but I think there are some valid questions around causality and perhaps the some issues around some particles affecting more than just the immediate time and space around them. Could you explore that for us, perhaps?
I get the impression you're probably more qualified to explore that than me. There are all kinds of interesting thoughts on how you know, how an event can sort of wrap around its past, and you know, whether there's a Large Hadron Collider by definition cannot actually work because it would create a situation which couldn't exist due to an event that it was caused in its past, or something like that, which are interesting ideas. I'm not sure I totally buy those. And again, as to what's God's role in all this, I think your views are probably, you know, everyone's view is probably very personal on this one. I mean, to start as to whether you believe there is a God, or whether you're strongly believe there is, or strongly believe there isn't, or don't know, that will probably colour your thoughts a lot. I mean, my view of someone who believes that there is a God is that I can't see myself as to why he would object to a Large Hadron Collider experiment any more than any other scientific experiment. However, as I said, that's, you know, who am I to tell God what to do or what to think? I don't think I can say any more, really. I mean, people, you know, you'll have your opinions and go for it if you want to share some of those.
Hi. I'd like to ask, if bubble chambers are the old technology for detecting particles, what are the current technologies for detecting, say, the Higgs boson?
Okay, so they're a little bit bigger than the bubble chambers. The ATLAS detector at CERN in the Large Hadron Collider is, off the top of my head, it's in my notes, I think it's basically, imagine a large cylinder 49 metres long and 25 metres diameter. That is essentially your ATLAS detector, and it's loaded with a whole realm of different electronic style devices for detecting different things about particles. And so it gives opportunities for particles to interact with the detector in various different ways. So it's, in fact, if, I don't know whether you saw the picture downstairs when you came in. The photograph down there is of the ATLAS detector. It's not something you can see now because the photograph was taken, it's a photograph that's been used very widely while the detector is being built. So all that empty space you see inside has been filled up with various bits of electronics. Now, I am not an expert on what goes on inside some of these detectors, but essentially you're detecting charged particles. Charged particles interact, or well, some of them won't be charged, but charged particles interact strongly with matter, and they interact in various ways which can be detected electronically. And then from that build up a huge three-dimensional picture of where the particles are going and various aspects of their nature. That's a bit vague, I know.
Some years ago about antimatter galaxies. So this is a bit of a puzzle. It's difficult basically behaves the same way. So therefore maybe their human beings would count down 10, 9, 8 instead of 1, 2, 3. And this is the date and the hour and the minute of the Large Hadron Collider. 10 to the 9th of the 8th, the 7th hour, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And negative numbers, you know, because, but they won't call, they'll call negative numbers positive numbers.
What makes you think they speak in English?
Let the imagination rip, I think.
I'm interested in what happened, what went wrong with the collider when they first had to go, and what kinds of things are they needing to do? It's taking a long time to get it back running again.
So a little bit more on the timetable. They've had beams back in the collider in the last couple of days. They had lead ions in there at the weekend, I think before last weekend, and had protons through one of the sexes, both directions, I think, a couple of days ago. So they're really getting close to getting this running again. So what happened last year is they kind of had this event called Switch On, which I think was 10th of September last year, and they it's a bad name for it, Switch On, because every bit of it was kind of tested anyway. So what they really meant by Switch On was they send a beam round the entirety of the tunnel one way, and they'll send a beam round the entirety of the tunnel the other way, and show in principle everything was there for it to get going. And they had all the press at the event there. Incidentally, if you read the CERN update at the moment, they're very coy about things at the moment. They don't have a big press gathering for the second switch on. They'll simply tell the press when it happens. If you're really keen, you can get a Twitter feed or a text feed, but I'm not that sad to actually subscribe to that. So what happened a couple of weeks after the initial switch on, while they were preparing for proper collisions, it essentially was an electrical fault. This caused one of the magnets that guide the beam. So these beams, protons, they go in a beam, they go in a circle because they're guided by strong magnets. So this caused one of the magnets to actually heat up. That in turn caused a leak of helium, liquid helium. These things are very cold, these liquid heliums cool it, and that caused all kinds of damage. Assessing the situation, they realised that some of the systems were actually under-designed for the tasks they had to do. So there's a lot of redesign work going on in that period. You know, if you go back, I think it was sort of happened in the middle of October last year. They initially hoped, you know, to get things going early New Year, early New Year, January last. But it soon became clear that there were some deep-seated problems with the actual design things, so they've done some redesign, rebuilding. They also took the opportunity to pull forward some routine maintenance on other bits. So essentially that led to basically a year's delay. Now they're going to run it at lower energy to start with. So we'll be seeing 3.5 tera-electron volts in each beam rather than 7 in each beam. But hopefully that will ramp up to higher energy data. And I should say 3.5 per beam is still a lot of energy. That's bigger than any other collider in existence.
Sorry to come back again, Marcus. This question is really very practical. But I understand that these particles are actually very small, and the collider will have to have some mechanism whereby the particles travelling in one direction, or one cycle, can actually impinge on the others coming in the other direction.
Yeah.
Now, even my limited knowledge of reality and physics baffles me as to how you can actually manage to align those particles so that they can collide. Is it a numbers game? Do you have so many particles shooting through in both directions that there is no chance of there not being a collision? Or do you have some control over this very, very thin beam of particles?
Yeah, you do have control on the two beams. They are very well designed to. Basically, you've got two beams coming opposite ways, and the four points around the ring are designed to actually cross over. So then they'll actually hit each other, or the idea. And there is control on actually focusing the beams in, so that they come through the same point in space. That's all done with magnets. You know, you couldn't do this with a neutron because neutrons aren't charged, but you can do it with protons. It all works because charged particles move, have a force and magnetic field. But it is very much a numbers game, yes. You have a lot of protons in there, and they're going around a lot of times, and occasionally you'll get some which essentially hit head on, but most of the time you won't.
Question at the back first, and then we'll put people at the front as well, Rob.
Experiments which are being done there is accelerating particles and then having them collide.
Yep.
And essentially, there's a lot of debris, and you study the debris.
Yep.
Now you're going to the experiments with much more energy, and there's much more or different kinds of debris. Now you hope to find something which is called a Higgs particle,
yep.
Which is, in my opinion, just a little extra piece of debris. Can you explain to me how, if you find this particle, how you can explain with that extra bit of debris something as general as mass, something which is of a much larger scale than just this one particle you find?
Okay, so I think you're asking how is it that these things called Higgs bosons actually give rise to something called mass? Okay. Kind of the mechanism is broadly like something that interacts a lot with the Higgs bosons has a lot of mass, that's broadly speaking. It's not that something with a lot of mass has a lot of Higgs bosons making it up. Kind of the way I've explained it in the past is that if I go on a walk through the bush with my father-in-law, I will walk at about 10 times the speed that he does. The reason is not that he walks slowly or that I walk particularly quickly, it's because every three steps he stops to take a photograph. So what he is doing is interacting with his environment a lot more than I am. So the analogy is that something with a little amount of mass interacts fairly weakly with the Higgs bosons, Higgs field. Something with a lot of mass interacts quite strongly. And that's basically the idea.
Some down the front.
Now, where do all these protons come from? How do you make them? What do you do with them to get them spinning? And how heavy are they when they spun?
Where do they come from? How do you get them spinning? And how heavy are they when they spun? Actually, I'm not entirely sure how the generation large hadron colliders and this may know about this, but they're kind of going to a pre-accelerator, which is something that existed at CERN anyway, and so the superproton synchrotron, I think, so they're kind of spun up to get them up to speed.
Yeah, but how do you get them to be protons?
How do you get them to be protons? You probably do it by some kind of radioactive decay to start with, and then accelerating the products from it. Someone may know more about how you get them, how they get the protons to start with. But once they've got them, they accelerate them up in a smaller ring and then inject them two ways around the big ring. They're extremely fast, so 14 tera electron volts is semi-semiconductor box, 99.999, quite a lot of 9s to light. Talking about the speed of something when it's going that fast isn't really useful. It's not a very useful measure. So the energy is a more useful measure, and you can think of that as things that, as they get closer to the speed of light, you try to accelerate them further, where does that energy go? Because it can't go into creating more velocity, because things do not travel faster than the speed of light. And you can think of it as going into creating more mass. That's one way of looking at it, and I think for the Large Hadron Collider, they're sort of boosting their mass by the order of about 10 times. Something around that. Again, I don't have a number. You gave me a couple of minutes so I could work it out for you, 14 electron volts, but I'm not even trying to do it in my head at the moment. A proton, by the way, is on its own weighs 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, something like that. I should know that number.
Does anybody here know the source of the protons on the Hadron Collider?
Essentially, a hydrogen atom is made up of one proton and one electron. So essentially, all you do is just ionize the hydrogen and then the electron. So the charge effect, you're in the electrons that you leave for the protons and from the ions. No, I don't know whether that's how they do it in soon, but then.
Yeah, that's a very powerful way, yeah.
I'm curious what you think the scientists involved might have been able to do better as far as the public perception. Obviously, it was a bit of a PR disaster from the sense that you suddenly had the guy in the street saying, we're doomsday machine sort of kill us all. That seems like a lot of steps they've gotten there. What do you think, when faced with the sort of media interest and the chance to talk about their work, they might have been able to do differently to get a more positive response from people?
Fantastic question. And I would have to admit that the physicist, I am guilty of some of that. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Curiously, if you go back, which I did, and read all the CERN press releases and so on the build-up to the event, there is nothing wrong with a CERN press release. In the sense that they are scientifically accurate, they do not, they explain that, yeah, it's perfectly safe. There is really nothing in the CERN releases which gets people, where there is real potential for misunderstanding. However, what obviously happened was that the media picks up on various aspects, and of course the possibility of black holes is a very interesting aspect to pick up on. I remember reading a report on this, must be at least 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, talking about the possibility of black holes being created in the particle accelerator. This was in the New Zealand Herald, in the science section, buried away in the middle. So the stuff was out there, but I think there was this public pickup on just a few things, and certain aspects of the media really drew on this. I don't really want to criticise these papers. Though I will mention the Sun newspaper in the UK. Those who know the UK and know the Sun will know it's not got a strong record for reliability, or reputation for reliability. And early September last year, it published a headline, End of the World Due in 9 Days. It's not a very helpful thing to publish. However, I'm not going to blame the media, because let's face it, which sounds more misplaced? The end of the world due in 9 days, or somewhere in Geneva, some bunch of future scientists are going to accelerate photons and crash into each other? Who cares about that? But really, the scientific community as a whole, and I count myself as that, I think missed a trick here in that as this interest was building in the public, we kind of failed to act to reassure. For example, running events like this. An event like this would have been brilliant to run sort of August last year. We actually ran one in Hamilton, but not until after CERN switch on. So I think the scientists collectively do have a little bit of blame here for not responding to some of the inaccuracies. Well, not so much inaccuracies in media reporting, but room for misinterpretation. And clearly, there was a lot of misinterpretation, as my wife's STEM instructor was a clear example of that.
Marcus, can I venture to say that you're really up against it? It's really about perception, and I'm a research scientist, some of my time, and I know, and most of us here who are scientists know, that at the very point of research, there is no morality, there is no ethics, because you don't know what's around the corner. And with the Hadron Collider, surely you've got this massive instrument, and you're going to switch on something and unleash something. How are you going to convince the public that you're doing the right thing? It's extremely difficult. And I think we got away lightly on this occasion, frankly. And I think the sun did a good job because it put up the straw man, which is so preposterous that everybody laughed and got on with life.
There's some lovely quotes from Brian Cox as well. Working in the UK on the Large Hadron Collider and made things and stuff on YouTube, and he had a few things to say about people who think the world's going to end. It's an equally strong word the other way.
It's a numbers game, achieving these collisions. What duration of time do they actually run the collider? Is it seconds, minutes, hours, days? And while it's running, what sort of power does it consume? How many megawatts of it?
I think they basically try to get potential for collisions there twice a day, I think, while it's running. And of course, quite likely, there will be nothing of interest happening. That's probably not true. I think probably any collision, any interaction that goes on is going to be of interest to someone in the physics community. But probably not the really sort of Higgs boson generating collisions. They're not going to happen very often. How much power does it suck from Geneva? I don't actually know. I would imagine it's a reasonable amount.
I've heard stories that they can't run a sequence up.
We need a microphone, or you need to repeat what he said.
I've heard stories that they can't run it in winter. I believe from, if you read the CERN schedule, that they're planning to run it through December and through the new year, so I guess that shows that they are going to run it through winter.
It's me again, I'm sorry. Third question. This is even more practical than the last one. Olson wrote a book very recently criticizing scientists for their ability to write.
Guilty.
I think that this is enough of what the last previous question was all about. That scientists can't communicate in the way that they should be able to, because they have a wonderful thing in their hand, and the whole of the world would benefit from this. And I would really like to hear your opinion, Marcus, on how you think scientists could improve the way that they speak to the nations.
Given that I stand in front of a cafe full of 100 people doing exactly what you could say I'm doing, which is not speaking very well. Certainly, I mean, that is a real issue. For example, I mean, as I said earlier, I organise Cafe Sans Feet events in Hamilton. And as part of that, I try to find speakers, people that will talk, you know, in this kind of environment. It's pretty well run, exactly as you see here. So it's amazing how many people I approach who say, so I don't want to do that. You know, well, speak in a cafe, speak without PowerPoint. Speak in words that aren't technical. You know, how do I do that? It's surprising how many people essentially refuse to speak. And that's disappointing. And I reckon they should be made to speak. If I had my way, I would drag them down there, sit them in front of the microphone, and tell them to get on with it. Incidentally, we ran a competition at the University of Waikato over the last month, which we borrowed from, I think, the University of Queensland, called Speaking 3. The idea is basically for PhD students to explain their work in 3 minutes. And the one concession is they are allowed to use one PowerPoint slide, so we don't ban PowerPoint entirely. That was fantastic. At the final last week, and eight thoroughly entertaining and very understandable talks across all areas of research. You know, the detailed science ones, there were the English literature ones, psychology talks. I mean, and it can be done. I mean, for those students, and these aren't, you know, this is, you know, somebody's early 20s. They don't have a long training in public speaking. They spoke brilliantly about the subject. 3 minutes, no technical language, they got it right across. It can be done, and I think we need more practice at it.
So we need to tell the people in Switzerland that. We'll be right. Any further questions? Just a couple more.
What's the reward in the funding system for scientists who are able to do public speaking?
The very short answer is none. There are longer answers than that. There are awards. For example, I think they very recently announced there was a Prime Minister's Award for Science Communication. So there are kind of, there are some rewards out there. Essentially, if you're in a sort of university academic job like myself, and really I can only comment for the University of Waikato, basically science communication does not come highly on the list of things that will get you a pay rise. You might think that's a bad thing. I think that's a bad thing. Maybe that will change. But just at the moment, science communication probably doesn't have the incentive for this shift.
It's getting a higher profile, Mark. So there is a professor of science communication now at Otago University, and there's one here. So. And you know, all the Crown Research Institute's on with GNS Science, but it is becoming more and more important. Now, some of you will remember that some years ago we had Lord May visiting, the President of the Royal Society of London, and he gave a high-profile talk at Parliament, and he made that very point, that the key to the future in science is communication. And I think most science organisations in the country have actually picked that up to some large extent. Yeah.
Sorry, not a question, but a comment. Back in the 19th century, when the £10 franchise was introduced in England, Lord Randolph Churchill said, we must now educate our masters. And I believe that that is essentially the message that we as scientists need to take on board. We need to educate our masters, not merely the politicians, but all of the taxpayers. And I think that the idea that we can, through clever public speaking, through clever public relations, get our message across quickly and easily, is not going to work. What we need to do is to spend much more time on ensuring that every child in school gets a grounding in science, and in particular, gets a grounding in physics. Until children get that, they won't understand what we're trying to tell them.
Yeah, that's a nice comment. Again, the word education is an interesting one, because people are moving now, perhaps in terms of from education of the public, as if there's something wrong with the public. They don't know something, and that's their problem. They need educating towards more engagement with the public. And I think there's a kind of a shift in perceptual thinking about how communication actually works. I'm not going to say it.
That's a really good point to end on. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Dr. Marcus Wilson.